Never let the facts get in the way of a good story. Welcome to American Esoterica. If history class gives you the what goes up, this is the must come down. The essential stuff in between. The personalities, events, and other ephemera that shape our history and culture. I'm Brian Powers. We're going to switch gears for a brief moment of indulgence. Call it a peek behind the curtain, a fourth wall break, a non-canonical aside. But to start this episode, I want to talk about the process of writing these episodes. See, when I set out to make this show, I wrote down every amusing, amazing, absurd, appealing, awkward, abhorrent, alluring, auspicious, and all-around awesome anecdote that had adhered assertively to my attention in abundance. The first 40 to 50 or so came straight from memory, and I added more topics as time went on. The problem, however, is that, as I started to research some of the subjects ingrained in my memory, it became clear that some of the stories I had heard, or at least how I remembered them, weren't entirely true. Awkward. For many of them, it was just that the version that had been relayed to me turned on a different set of facts than what I had been told. So once I had set the record straight, I could use the real story and go from there. This is evident in stories such as those of Haim Salomon, in that George Washington probably didn't burst through the doors of a synagogue on Yom Kippur like the Kool-Aid Man, exhausted and forced to beg for money to continue the American Revolution. Likewise, the way I had originally heard the story of Benjamin Franklin and his son, it was good old Ben pulling all the strings and preventing Washington or Congress from releasing his son for prison or letting him see his wife despite their protestations. The reality was just a tad less, shall we say, evil. He did refuse to lift a finger to help, but it wasn't out-and-out torture. The same is true for the episode about Aaron Burr's final days. I'm not going to spoil it, but the popular retelling passed down through time is that a very coincidental individual served as Burr's estranged wife's attorney in their divorce. And it's heavily implied that the delivery of the final decree, with the attendant signature of that ironic participant, was such a blow that Burr up and died the day he received it. But no, that person did help her hide her assets, but he wasn't her attorney. And the divorce was still tied up in the legal system when Burr died, which rendered it moot, and therefore final as of the day of his death, leading to historical confusion. There are several more examples just from existing episodes, such as the story of the origin of NORAD's Santa Tracker, which is now told in its more fanciful and not quite true version on a yearly basis by those whimsical flibbertigibbets over at NPR. There were also just those topics that I had somehow done my own embellishment on, like when I became convinced that Teddy Roosevelt's First Amendment Protection Squad of all Jewish police officers for a notorious anti-Semite were assigned to protect that speaker only until a certain physical boundary, and then, when both he and they were across this imaginary line around the corner from public view, they were to consider themselves off-duty, with all the attendant implications. That would have been hilarious, but it didn't happen that way. We finally get to that last class of topics, those that spun a good yarn, but were pretty much fabrications. Whether by word of mouth growing the legend over time, or overly ambitious biographers injecting extra life into ones that, on paper at least, were sagging. Think about George Washington and the cherry tree, for instance. Those are the most heartbreaking, because they're literally too good to be true, and several have been swept in the waste bin as a result, but not all of them. There are a few that I knew to be false even before I began this show, but I've never been able to shake them. They're just too fun. I've been looking for a place to slot them in, and here we are. So let's play a game. I'm going to tell you three quick historical anecdotes. Two of them aren't really true, but have been and still are passed off as being so by reputable news sources in the same way those salacious slap-arounds at NPR did just recently with one of them. One actually is true. See if you can spot it. Here we go. Ulysses S. Grant hated being president. The country was still in turmoil just 4 short years after the end of the Civil War, the death of that other guy, and somebody had finally gotten the hint that maybe they needed to tighten up security at the White House. Prior to this, average citizens could just walk in on past the guards, but no more. Someone had ruined all the fun. So Grant became very lonely all by himself in the big mansion at the exceedingly advanced age of a whole 46. And so he escaped. On many afternoons, Grant would wander out the eastern side of the executive mansion, mosey around the Treasury building, ensconce himself in the comfort of the lobby of the Willard Hotel, which still exists today. There, he would partake of his favorite snack, brandy and a cigar, and hold court with anyone who happened to be around. As this became a habit, it became known that if you wanted to bend the president's ear on a matter of legislative importance, all you had to do was find a spot in the lobby of the Willard and wait on Grant to come calling. The Willard became the de facto center of political life, and Grant coined a term for the people who camped out in the lobby, hoping to persuade him in the direction of their interests. Lobbyists. Speaking of the Treasury building, let's talk about how it found its location. It is in an odd place, right up next to the east wing of the White House, pretty much almost on its grounds. If the Secretary of the Treasury were taking a shower in the building, he or she need only yell out the window, and the president could pop on over to provide a bar of soap. Not only is it in close proximity to the White House, but the Treasury Department stands as the single greatest impediment to the realization of Pierre L'Enfant's vision for the layout of Washington, D.C. I'll go into this in depth really soon. But the short version is that L'Enfant designed the streets of Washington so that the White House and the Capitol were in a direct line of sight down Pennsylvania Avenue. That was fine until the Treasury building sprang up, completely blocking the view. So how did it get there? President Andrew Jackson was in a bitter feud with Congress, yet another in a long line of them. This time, the fight was over where to build a home for the Treasury Department. Frustrated and finally having enough, Jackson stormed out of the White House and stood at the edge of the White House lawn, staring angrily at his antagonists in the Capitol. That's when inspiration struck. Jackson discovered a solution to the problem that would also keep him from having to look at Congress from his house. He speared the tip of his cane hard into the ground at that spot, yelling, "Build the damn thing here!" And the Treasury building has been impeding the view ever since. Speaking of views, William McKinley loved his wife Ida desperately, but he had one exceptionally odd way of showing it. Ida had developed epilepsy, probably as a result of a fall that caused a head wound, and she was prone to occasional seizures. Before they found their way to the White House, they would have guests for dinner, and on at least one occasion, the guests were utterly shocked when Ida had a seizure right there at the table. The shocking part was not the seizure itself, but McKinley's reaction to it. As he noticed the seizure begin, he calmly picked up a napkin, placed it over her face, and then went back to eating as if nothing was amiss. When the seizure was over, Ida pulled the napkin off and she too calmly resumed eating, with neither her nor McKinley remarking on the incident. Their guests, which included a future president, were utterly flabbergasted. But what seemed like a callous disregard for his wife's dignity was an act of love. Ida didn't want guests to see her contorted features as she suffered a seizure, so McKinley's napkin provided a barrier. When McKinley became president, he changed dining protocol at formal events to have Ida sit next to him instead of across from him, just in case, although there isn't any evidence that he got to perform his napkin trick at a state dinner. So, which is the true story? Is it Grant giving us lobbyists? Jackson vetoing his view of Congress? Or McKinley doing napkin tricks with his wife's face? Now let's talk about it. The Willard Hotel publicists recount the story of Grant holding court and inadvertently naming a new American institution. Thing is, the word lobbyist had been around for a while before his presidency, appearing in print first in England, and it referred to those hanging around the lobbies of Parliament. Sorry, wrong answer. The United States Treasury Department website explained Andrew Jackson's famous role in determining the site of the building. At least, it used to. Nowadays, it instead briefly recaps the enduring legend, which is code for a load of bunk, considering there was already the site of the previous Treasury building, which had been selected by George Washington and had just burned down. Now, the rumor then shifted to be that Jackson wanted the building bigger to block the view, but still, there's no actual evidence for Jackson and his legendary cane or shovel or whatever he stuck into the ground. Strike two. So that brings us to the McKinleys. The napkin story is true, according to no less a source than President Chief Justice William Howard Taft, who witnessed it personally as a dinner guest. And no, he did not get stuck in the bathtub. No good story gets through history unscathed, however. The popular version is that McKinley would drape the napkin over Ida at state dinners full of horrified foreign dignitaries, which is not true. No, their napkin play only took place in the privacy of their own home, as it should be. This has been American Esoterica. All sounds were made by me, Brian Powers. Did I get it wrong? Did I get it right? Just want to send me something? Anything? Please, write me. I'm so lonely. Drop me a note. The address is yell@AmericanEsoterica.com. More information on this show and its episodes can be found at AmericanEsoterica.com. Thank you for listening, and God bless America.